Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Thank you for joining us today. The next 2 hours are devoted to learning something more, not just about the world of shoes and ships and sealing wax, but about how, what, and why we believe as we do. A time for the open-minded, willing to challenge some of those old ideas behind what we think we know, who we are, and who we might become. Enlightenment is a term traditionally used to describe a period in Western philosophy and cultural life, centered upon the 18th century, in which reason was advocated as the primary source of legitimacy for authority. We acknowledge this usage, but we seek to enlarge upon it, adding the idea of experiencing the quintessential truth about ourselves, ever seeking the possibility of an epistemological certainty, that level of knowing from within, who we really are, why we are here, and what we do with the lives we live. I'm Eldon Taylor, and this is Provocative Enlightenment. We have a special chat room with some very special folks that join us every week, so don't miss out. Okay, Rav, tell us all about what makes your chat room so special.
Oh, we have the best chat room ever. We have a great group of people. You know, it brings an added dimension to your current interview. We have questions going on, lots of bits of advice.
All right. Now, every week I read some of your letters as our way of paying respect to the very important role you play in making this show successful. But before we get to that, I have invited Suze Casey to join today in order to express my gratitude to her. Suze had this 11 o'clock time slot, I should say, 11 to noon, for her show, Flipping the Switch. And she graciously agreed to move her show in order to make available a two-hour slot for Provocative Enlightenment. So, welcome to Provocative Enlightenment, Suze, and once again, thank you very much for this opportunity.
Eldon, it's my absolute pleasure to support you and your work on CTR Network. I know that listeners are going to find it as fascinating as I do.
Well, thank you. Tell us, what is your new time slot?
I've moved to Thursdays, and Thursdays at 2 p.m. Pacific, so that's 3 p.m. Mountain Time and 5 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you're in any other time zone, you have to do your own math. I can manage it that far.
Thursday at 2 Pacific, though.
Thursday at 2 Pacific, Flipping the Switch with Suze, and I'm moving the show will stay the same, lots of callers, and we'll do repatterning on air and support people moving through some old belief systems so that they can come to a new place of awareness and enlightenment.
Okay, well, you know, I'm sure that some of your listeners are listening now, and many of the people that we have brought here to CTR are familiar with your show, but for all of us, just in case, tell us about your show, Flipping the Switch. What is the aim, the objective? Why are you doing it, Suze?
Thanks for asking, Eldon. It's based in the technique that I developed called belief repatterning. And my background is as an educator. I have a master's degree in education, and I decided about 35 years ago that it had to be a whole lot easier than it was. And so about 25 years ago, I quit banging my head against the wall and went, okay, if it has to be easier, then why don't I make it so? And so I began to apply educational learning theory to working my way through challenges and realized that, you know, the things that I was experiencing in my life were simply reflections of the beliefs that I held, and that if I could shift those beliefs easily and with grace and with some fun, that that I could just keep moving and growing and learning. And I watched little kids and watched how we kind of put things together and developed a really quite simple technique. It's a bit like chess, simple to learn and a little bit longer to master it. But, you know, it's something that rubber hits the road and is very pragmatic. And I just love watching people move through those places where they've been stuck into a new reality, and so they can create what they truly desire and deserve.
Well, now, you know, it sounds like you and I do quite a bit of collateral work. I mean, the power of belief, that indeed one of my books is titled, I Believe When Believing in Yourself Matters. So I happen to have your book. I've ordered it. And you and I have talked about you being a guest on this show. I think we're pretty well booked until into the first of the year. But are you willing to join me as a guest as soon as we can schedule you in, Suze?
I would be absolutely thrilled to join with you, Alden, and just, you know, take a look at, because I'm fascinated by the work that you do as well. You come at it from a much more scientific, and I come at it from a much more soft and personal, and where we meet in the middle, I think, is awesome. And I'm excited to explore that with you and to have your listeners and my listeners in on the conversation, because I think it'll be an incredible one.
So am I. I'm really excited about that. Okay, one last thing, Suze. Do you have anything else that you'd like to leave our listening audience with today?
I would just like to encourage everyone to have a really good listen to Eldon and the people that he brings on, because he has his finger on the pulse of some very, very interesting new thought, and it will be provocative and different kind of show than what I do, but wow, you're going to have some great information and some things to be thinking about and moving you forward in other really interesting ways, and I'm really excited that my colleague Eldon from Hay House, because we're both published with Hay House, my book, Belief Repatterning and the Amazing Technique for Flipping the Switch, and his several books on Hay House, and to have both of us over here on CTR, I think we can, you know, really enjoy having some cross-referencing of people. They're going to learn some things from both sides, and I'm excited about that opportunity.
Well, again, Suze, I want to thank you for making this opportunity available for us, and I'm excited about working more with you, and I want to encourage everybody that's listening to tune in to Flipping the Switch on Thursdays at 2 p.m. Pacific. And as Sue said, if you live somewhere besides Pacific, I'll let you do the time arrangement. Thanks for joining us, Sue.
Take care.
You have a great one now.
You bye-bye. As well. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, now to your letters. Hannah wrote, I enjoy listening to you. I admire your honesty. I love when people speak straight. I am the same way. Thank you, Dr. Taylor. Cyril wrote, heard you on Coast to Coast with George Nuri, and I must say I was very impressed with your interview, examples, and work. Carl wrote, when I heard you with George Nuri, I was impressed with your observation that only by increasing consciousness will we be able to confront and deal with the pressing realities facing us today. Ingrid wrote, thank you, Dr. Taylor, for being you and sharing your findings and treasures with us. And John wrote, I love how you do radio. Well, thank you, John. I do love doing it. Okay, that's all the time we're going to take for letters today, but I do invite you to opine by sending your email to eldon@eldontaylor.com or by joining me on Facebook. We can't get all of your letters on the air, but they do impact our programming. And once again, I both appreciate and thank you for your feedback and continued support. If you're new to this show, you may enjoy our archives. You can find over 5 years of archives at provocativeenlightenment.com. During the past 5 years, we've interviewed Hollywood greats, politicians, psychics, former CIA personnel, heart scientists, skeptics, philosophers, social psychologists, best-selling authors, and you name it, including a few channels and mediums. We have charted the waters of parapsychology, psychic phenomena, UFOs, NDEs, physics, psychology, brainwashing, and much more. If any of that sounds like your kind of radio, be sure and check out our archives, again, at provocativeenlightenment.com. Now to today's show. On the Edge of Reality with Colin Andrews and his lovely wife, Dr. Cynthia Andrews. Many of you have sent letters asking about such things as chemtrails, crop circles, orbs, and secret technology. Well, here's your show. For all of that and more is the subject of the new book, On the Edge of Reality. So let me tell you a little about our guests. Colin Andrews is a veteran researcher of unusual phenomena. Since 1983, he has supplied the public and British government with pioneering research. Colin is known around the world for his groundbreaking work with crop circles, a term he coined, UFO and consciousness research. He has recently attracted international attention with his discovery of the radar anomalies in Australia, subsequently confounding the Australian Bureau of Meteorology, and we're going to get into that today. He is the co-author of two best-selling books and the author of four alternative science classics. His website is www.colinandrews.net, where he receives up to 23,000 visitors a day. Now, that's a lot of traffic, but I've been to the site, I've checked it out, and I can tell you, I understand why there are that many visitors. Colin has appeared in over 100 television documentaries, including productions by National Geographic, Discovery, and History's Mysteries. He is currently featured in two documentaries to be released in 2012 by National Geographic and Norwegian Television. He has been featured on 60 Minutes 2020 with Barbara Walters, Good Morning America, Sightings, Unsolved Mysteries with Robert Stack, Coast to Coast, The Shirley MacLaine Show, Dan Aykroyd's Out There, The Sally Jesse Raphael Show, BBC's Daytime Live, and the list goes on. I'm just going to stop. Now, Dr. Cynthia Andrews has been in the world of holistic health for over 25 years. Her work is focused on the resolution and relief of pain and its underlying mechanical, metabolic, emotional, or traumatic causes. She has recently expanded her scope of practice to include naturopathic medicine in order to assist people even further in their quest for pain-free living. She is the author or co-author of 8 books, including The Path of Energy. So now what is she doing dealing with orbs? Well, we're going to find out about that too. So let's get them in here. Welcome to Provocative Enlightenment, Colin and Cynthia Andrews.
Thank you, Eldon. It's great to be with you.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Indeed, our pleasure. I'm very much looking forward to this conversation. But in order to proceed without, you know, speaking over one another, if it's okay, I'll generally try to ask you questions directed at each of you individually. But please don't let that stop you from feeding each other as is natural. So to begin with, around here we like to know 3 things. What is the message? Who is the messenger? And how do we use the information? So if we may, let's start with you, Colin. Tell us, what is your background and how did you get involved with this work?
Well, my background is that I'm an electrical engineer by profession. I've spent all of my life up until things changed with regard to these subjects right back in 1983. But I was a senior official in regional government in Great Britain. And when things, you know, basically dropped off the line as far as my profession was concerned, I became involved in, first of all, the crop circle subject, which I just happened to see a set of 5 of these circles in a wheat field in 1983. You know, it was just a regular day on my way to a meeting. And that really changed everything for me. You know, my government work, my profession slowly but surely got curtailed and dropped away out of sight. And here I am today with certainly with a message. I've learned in the last 30 years of research, being basically one subject hand passing me like a baton to another, onto another, from UFOs to consciousness. And, you know, slowly but surely, the information came together to write this particular book. So, you know, I have a message which I think will come out in our program. That's who I am. I advised the Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's cabinet on this subject, and also the head of state, the Queen Elizabeth, also. So that basically, in a nutshell, is me, Eldon.
Okay, Colin. I mean, so we've got some pretty impeccable credentials there. I'd like to sit with the Queen or Margaret Thatcher. Cynthia, how did you get involved in crop circles, orbs, UFOs, and the like? And were you ever skeptical of this sort of thing?
Well, that's a very good question. Yes, I was skeptical of these things, but, you know, I started my own research into subtle energy and emotions when I was 12 years old and had parents who were very, very awakened to this type of thing. My father was a medical doctor and my mother was a professional woman, and both of them were taken with crop circles. And so my mother actually dragged me to a crop circle convention where I met Colin, and we recognized each other. And, you know, have been working together ever since. And so really my work into subtle energy and emotions and his work into alternative phenomenon kind of came together beautifully, because what I do explains the experiences people have and helps people to relate to what's happening in their body when they undergo these, you know, types of experiences. And, you know, really, for me, the message in all of this is that right now we're at a time in history where things are changing at such a rapid rate, people can't keep up. And the old ways of doing things, our old ways of thinking and solving problems, don't work for the situation we're in right now. So we are forced in this bottleneck situation to access different parts of ourself. And it's an awakening. And I think, you know, more important than anything else right now is to understand how that impacts you on a very physiologic and emotional level, and then to be able to step forward and be your best self in the changes underway.
And I definitely want to go there, but you touched on something I have to ask, because I was visiting England over 20 years ago, and I don't know, about 25 now, lecturing at Imperial College, and this young lady walked in, and we recognized each other, too. I want to know how you're using that terminology. You recognized each other.
Well, yeah, it is an interesting way of looking at it. But when, you know, he was talking up there, and I started to have experiences in the audience, and I needed to talk to him about those experiences. You know, I was kind of bilocating, actually, which is, I've never had that kind of thing happen before. So I went out into the hallway to talk to him, and there were about 60 people just pressing him against the wall, shooting questions at him. And for some reason, I still, to this day, don't understand. I walked around all those people and went to stand alongside of him against this wall and just face them and kind of help him manage all this energy coming at him. And at the end of it, when he turned to look at me, we looked at each other, and it was as if there were no barriers. We knew each other. We knew each other completely, and we knew our future together, and it was just immediate.
Cool.
If I may be, sorry, Eldon, just to add to that, because I'm the other half, you see.
Yeah, please.
Of that equation. the experience for me was as Cynthia has described it, but there was another piece which was very profound, and one of these synchronistic kind of experiences that kind of followed me from that point on. I was back in England before I'd actually kind of headed out on that particular trip where I met Cynthia. I had sent a number of aerial photographs during our surveillance flights for these crop markings. You know, we were running regular flights in southern England around Stonehenge looking for them. And, you know, some of the more intricate patterns that were evolving at that time, this is late 80s into the early 90s, I had high-quality aerial photographs and dispatched them to a person who offered to attempt for me to locate one of two people that held the knowledge of the Hopi prophecy. And that was the reasoning for that, was that I had felt, it was basically coming from inside of me without any real particular evidence at that time, that the native peoples might have something to say about these patterns. At that time, you know, it was a complete mystery to us in every sense. And so I was looking for one of two people in the United States that I was told had this knowledge of the prophecy. Well, I headed out to Australia, around the back of the planet to the west coast of the U.S., and went across the center of the country and did several presentations, arriving near New Haven University in Connecticut, where I met Cynthia. And as she was saying, I was backed up to the wall after the presentation. I know you have these kind of experiences, too, where people want to ask questions that they perhaps not have the courage to ask, you know, during the presentation. And there was Cynthia, my eyes locked. That was the first thing that happened. It was as if, like, these eyes mean something, this person means something. Right. And virtually the first words out of her mouth was that, I think you'd like to meet a friend of mine. I think this, you know, you maybe you've got some things to talk about. And this person was indeed one of the two people I was looking for. And there was this thump, literally, I've never been able to explain it, nobody can, I don't think. There was a physical thump inside of my head, like somebody had hit me on the head with a hammer at that moment. And that's how we came together.
I've been there, done that. We'll talk about it after the break, but we've got a hard break here. So we're speaking with Colin and Cynthia Andrews about their work and book, On the Edge of Reality. It's a great book. I want you to read it. Do stay tuned. You don't want to miss what's coming up after a few words from some of our friends.
Do you feel like you've become lost in a funhouse? Only seeing the reflection of yourself, past, future, and present, but unable to find the real you? I invite you to step through the doorway and onto the path leading to understanding of your mind, your choices, and the influences that surround you. Read Elton Taylor's New York Times best-selling book, Choices and Illusions, now expanded, updated, and revised. It will provide you with real-life examples of how you can break free from your current perceptions and begin your journey to how high is up. Get your copy today from all bookstores or online from Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble.
Confusion, deception, manipulation, feeling a bit controlled, lost. Learn how you can take back control of your life through proven techniques in Eldon Taylor's revised edition of Choices and Illusions. This New York Times bestseller is a guidebook to your journey to self-actualization, filled with practical, real-life solutions backed by scientific studies and guaranteed to awaken your inner genie. Get your copy today from all bookstores.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor. Now, back to the show.
And welcome back. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Colin Andrews and Cynthia Andrews about their book, On the Edge of Reality. But before we get back to the show, I do want to invite you to join me on Facebook as a friend or a fan. I post regularly everything from where I am and what's on next to the latest in science, technology, and consciousness studies. And from time to time, some of my own opinions about the world we live in. All right, before the break, Colin, you had that thump that you knew this was the one feeling. and as I said, you know, I've been there, done that. It happened almost like that to me. My wife is sitting across from me now with a big grin on her face. I think that's just, you know, that's a marvelous story. And it also speaks, I think, to some of the things that we're going to be talking about as we go along here, particularly those relative to states of consciousness. But we have a lot to talk about, and especially I want to talk about crop circles. But first, let me ask you about some other matters that you've investigated, both of you, I think. But you've written about them in your book. I have done some work myself here, and I do think this is a very controversial issue. I want some bottom line. Tell me about chemtrails. Are they real? Are we really dropping stuff in the atmosphere? And if so, why?
Well, I've had grave suspicions myself that this was no more than a misinterpretation of a normal phenomena of normal contrails following aircraft. And that is indeed the view that I held up until probably 2-3 years ago. What changed it for me, Eldon, was that I was open to the information. I was being sent a lot, much like probably yourself, people that were concerned about it. And, of course, as the Internet came into full throb, as it were, those that were pushing out concerns and so-called evidence of chemtrails, more and more people became concerned. So that was kind of the background. But I was looking for data and looking, as you're saying, the hard bottom line myself. Well, I have a medical doctor friend who, you know, I hold in great regard, a very intelligent man, processes information well. We spend a lot of time with one another. And he has been looking at this and concerned about it for quite some time. It would, you know, at times call me and ask me to look out the window at what's going on over my head right now, because he lives a few miles to the south. And, things very definitely changed when I was sat outside of our barn. We live on a small farm here in Connecticut, with the flight paths out of JFK, Newark, and LaGuardia, New York airports, running over our heads pretty well, one or two to the north and a few to the south, some directly over the top, and aircraft are a very regular sight. And evenings, you know, sometimes I'll grab a coffee and sit out in the barn, enjoy the birds singing, etc. Sure. And here come the aircraft, normal contrail, nothing I can see abnormal. Then there were three different aircraft. And this was in the same weather conditions, the other normal aircraft out of the New York airports were leaving contrails that were evaporating back into the atmosphere at the forward rate of the aircraft itself, and that's a normal situation. These other three aircraft had a solid voluminous output. They did not dissipate. They remained there from horizon to horizon, or the aircraft disappeared to the north. They were still visible to beyond the horizon. And this material, three lines, in separate lines, separated on the horizontal by, I would imagine, several thousands of feet. It's very hard to tell, but looking to be at about the same height of the regular aircraft, but these three were behaving very differently. There was a different material. They were behaving differently in the sense that a lateral wind shear was spreading this material thinly across as a veil. Eventually, that's how they finished up. Other aircraft that were going through this material were dragging the material into the vortex behind the aircraft that they were flying. Those were regular aircraft. Well, I left immediately. I grabbed a camera. I got photographs. One of them is in the book. I grabbed my camera. I took the photographs. I got it in here on the internet. I looked up and spoke to a few sources that I've got. I went on to the radar track for the last 15, 20 minutes and saw the regular aircraft that I had seen and their call signs, where they were going to and from. But the three aircraft that were different had their information removed from the radar traces. So their transponders were literally taken out by somebody off the system. And so that began for me a really serious investigation in parallel with other things I was looking at. And led me to, you know, in detail it's in the book, but led me to whistleblowers that are inside the system, this program, of, it would seem, undeclared to the public, secret operation, but an attempt to increase the reflectivity of the upper atmosphere to reduce, it would seem, global warming. That is the best information that I'm able to get, still not declared to the public. And the material, it has been measured in a number of places. Other friends that are involved in that, with aluminum particles, very fine particles, harmful materials to health, that are now showing up. Although in recent months, for other reasons I of course am not privy to, there has been a drastic reduction in the reports of chemtrails from the usual places. So that's my take on it. Very much a non-believer. Now, I very definitely believe there is something going on there.
Yeah, and if I could break in for just a moment, I think it's very interesting that in February of 2010, at the American Association for the Advancement of Science Symposium, different scientists came forward and proposed a program to dump 10 to 20 megatons of aluminum substances into the atmosphere for the purpose of reflecting sunlight back into space. And it just seems to me that it was very much too close to what's actually being said is happening to be a coincidence.
I think you're absolutely right, Cynthia. I was going to bring that up myself. I indeed had the opportunity to, I was told by a former military a member of the Air Force about how they loaded this material on planes. Now, what was in the material, she wasn't able to say for sure, but they loaded it on the planes, and of course the planes came back without it. So I think there isn't a question about whether or not they're putting it into the air. The aluminum, however, is very alarming, and as you both bring out in your book, there are a lot of health issues attached to that. What do you do, Colin, when you come across this kind of information? What is the public to do with it, and what is the recourse? I mean, let's assume that we just we were able to, without a doubt, validate, or through the Freedom of Information Act, obtain material, or a whistleblower would stand up and testify before a House subcommittee. What is it that we as citizens can do about these things?
I think it's a very good question, of course. I think the very best that we can do is to pressurize, you know, those voted elector, the representatives that, you know, we put in positions of power on our behalf. I think that's all we can literally do, is to be much more, you know, proactive is to get involved, you know, use the internet, get on to these people. I think all of us are looking at this crossroads that we are now on that Cynthia was referring to, and yourself. You know, I think what we're all doing is looking for a change of attitude and mind. You know, look for transparency and honesty. And each of these subjects, although we're talking about chemtrails right now, there are many others that are programs that are secret to one level or another.
And we're going to go to some of those too.
Oh, right. Well, you know, what I think what it does, it pieces together an overall feeling, an overall sense, that rather than it's us on the same page at a difficult time for humanity, is that it's us and them. It's us not knowing what they are doing. And I think, I don't think it is going to change or has the ability to change overnight. But slowly but surely, with the pressure and changes in this, the paradigm shift, the paradigm movement, you know, it is, as it takes place, congeals a little more power to our hands. And so I think we can only hope that the concerns that we have and those concerns that we voice, and hopefully not with the evidence that we have a failing society due to some of these technologies, let's hope that we can change where we're going before all of that might well fall into place. You know, playing God with genetic engineering and so on, it just goes on and on and on. The military often getting hold of technology before we can utilize it for our good. You know, we're fighting wars with it. And so, you know, the subject is very wide, and this crossroads that we're on is multifaceted. I think the voice that we have through the internet, and knowing, you know, who our friends are and who you can count on to support this constant thrust in a better direction, is hopefully our best shot.
Let me sense something by both of you, okay? Because I totally concur. I think we have to be proactive today. I mean, I don't believe that we can just sit back any longer and depend on somebody else to start a petition, to talk to the neighbor, to make some noise, to investigate, to check out the channels. That's kind of where I am. But
yeah,
there is a lot of parlance in the new age environment, particularly that, you know, well, if you tune into this thing, you're kind of creating it. You really don't want to pay attention to that stuff. You know, it's, you know, the mind can create all these things. And so there is this division of ideas about consciousness in it, where part of us, I'm saying, I think we need to be activists. We need to be informed. We need to be doing something. I think that's our responsibility. But there are those that are saying, no, 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 no. You don't even want to pay any attention to that. You give it power when you do. That's the. What do you say, both of you?
Yeah, I'll start that out, Eldon. It's very interesting. We received a lot of criticism when we were putting this book together from different people about the idea that we wanted to put some of these hidden technologies in a book about the paranormal and about the evolution of consciousness. But in our opinion, you really can't change what you don't know about, and it's the lack of information is the biggest issue that we're at. I am probably in the New Ager camp in terms of the types of things I research and work with. However, in my experience, people like Lynn McTaggart and she's just one of many different scientists who are working with the power of intention and, intentional experiments for creating peace, for actually influencing molecules. And if we're at the point of thinking that consciousness is a force that we can interact with and direct, then this is key information for us to be working with, and maybe chemtrails is a place to start with it.
Yeah, I agree. And I would add to that the intuition that each of us has, perhaps some more than others, you know, it's there for a reason. And, if the basic sincere thrust of who we are is to seek out truth, then whether or not it's in the New Age camp or outside of it, whether the subject matter that we're looking at is real or not real, or should be looked at or shouldn't be tackled, It is the truth that we're looking for in all of it. And the example I would give is actually a part of my path that I've trodden has been 10 to 15 years, which was great, very, very difficult for me because for the very reason that you stated there, I was looking at that point at the crop circle phenomenon and had announced on BBC television that during the year 2000, after a two-year period of intensive investigation of those crop markings made by people, I announced to a world made up of many people that believed all of them were real, and a hardcore of, I'm just going to use the term believer, that's abused at times, I don't mean that disrespectfully, but people that believed that they were all made, you know, were all real, were tended to be the people that had an industry of some sort running on that belief system, and you might say had a religion in the making. Well, had I gone along with the advice of do not touch that, do not listen to Colin Andrews, do not listen to what he's saying, that 80% at that time were made by people, I would have missed the golden nuggets of what actually is going on inside of that mystery. And so, you know, it was only by the fact that I didn't like the arrows that were being shot at me, the hate mail that I was getting, etc. But I knew my truth. I knew the information that I was that I had gained through a hard investigation was what the public needed to know. And having kind of traversed that particular experience meant a lot to me because, you know, I can see that when you start to tread water in difficult ground, as long as you know who you are and why you are seeking that information, you know, whether it is ego-driven or whether you're looking for more hope and, you know, for a better world for my children, you know, it really comes down to who you are, I think, as to how you react to these different situations.
Well, I'm going to come back and say I think it's incumbent upon all of us to be informed. I happen to subscribe to that theory that, you know, what makes the human condition different from the rest of the animal kingdom is our intelligence. And as Clifton Fadiman said, either God gave us intelligence as a plague or the ability to think as a gift. Given that, you know, we simply need to be informed so that we can participate in this world in ways that improve the world, in ways that seek the peace that we're all after. That's my two bits. Listen, I'm going to pass this one, let you decide who gives me the answer, but my wife and I have taken a lot of photographs of orbs. But, you know, every time it really has turned out to be, you know, light or a water drop caught on the camera lens. I mean, tell me this. Are orbs real? And if so, what are they trying to communicate?
That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
Right, well, I'm a photographer myself, Alden, so I'm very interested in this, and having obviously also spent many years looking at the UFO subject, there's a reason why I would need to know a lot about them. And I agree with you wholeheartedly that many of those that I've taken myself, and no doubt you have, and that we are sent by you know, people that have an interest in this, are water droplets. I mean, we've many experiments on this. Water droplets, dust particles, foreign matter of one sort or another, you know, a high humidity atmosphere. Often, and more often than not, when the camera is placed on the automatic and calls for light, it activates the flash system, and whether a 35 millimeter or a digital, although digital does tend to, I think, produce more of these, you have your orb. And so we can explain, I think, most of them in that way, but certainly not all of them. And I would subscribe to the fact that some of them are real, and I could show evidence of that. We talk about it in the book, and we've on the website, you know, people can see movies of these. They really fall into two camps. One are the orbs that appear on our 35 millimeters in the, you know, in the past, and the digital cameras of the current day. Now, here's just one example of how we know this to be so. back a few years, this is an example that I was involved in myself, making a presentation in Chicago at the International MUFON Conference. Three individuals, three different cameras, within a few seconds of one another, one with the time period stamped on the photograph, took photographs of me up on the podium, and with an orb over the top of my head. None of the listeners should think that I'm painting a picture of some special Colin Andrews here. I'm just simply talking about orbs. And these orbs in these three photographs were in the same place over the top of my head. Now, that's very hard to believe that three cameras would pick up on a single piece of dust in a different orientation. They were in different places in the room, and yet the same orb was over the top of my head in those three photographs. It's just one example of many. True. That we've been able to say, well, that orb is certainly not dust, water, or dust particles. But that's the still photography. Then you have the movies, where we have orbs again, and there are three or four extremely convincing videos that have been analyzed by photographic experts. The military have had a look at them, for me from some years ago. And these are orbs about 18 inches in diameter that are moving intelligently, and I think there's that word that is important, that these orbs know where they are. They are appearing to certainly be aware of the topography in the environment, moving with regard to the crop markings from one to another, looking down at tractor tire marks that traverse the fields in the sowing and harvesting system in Europe. Tractor tire marks where they sow the seed and then they use the same tire marks across the field to put all the chemicals on that we then finish up eating. These orbs are dropping down into those tire marks as if they want to know more about those tire marks also. And so I could go on, but they are real. I have no doubt whatsoever they are real. They're on the films. They're on the movies. They move intelligently. And one category of orb I do believe we need to classify as the UFO in the classical sense, that this is an intelligently controlled object of some sort. Unidentified.
All right, and I want to come back to that. But now, Cynthia, this one, I mean, still on orbs, this one's really in my mind for you, because there are so many people that have spoken to me very sincerely about orbs that they feel that they're communicating with them. And yet, when I look at it, every single one of them are females. It's as though they're more inclined to be empathically connected or something. You've witnessed orbs. Do they communicate with you?
Well, you know, that goes right back to the idea of what are they. And I'm going to throw this in and add it to Colin's story about the three photographs, because there was a person that was supposed to be in that lecture hall who didn't join the lecture. He was asleep up in his room. And he came downstairs afterwards before we even knew we had these orbs on. And he said, "Don't worry, I didn't miss your lecture. I came down in my astral body and I watched what was going on." And we were like, laughing at it. Mm-hmm. But then later, when those pictures came through, we thought, well, I don't know, why not? And then I got to thinking about Walt Disney, who was actually a pretty esoteric guy. And in his early cartoons, you would see ghosts suddenly becoming balls of light and traveling around the room and then unfolding into a form again. And so I started to think about these as vehicles of consciousness. And I started to notice that a lot of the photographs that come in that are unexplained are around the bellies of pregnant women or are in the rooms where people are dying. And so I think that there is a possibility that these are vehicles for consciousness. And so, therefore, yes, why wouldn't they be able to communicate to us if we are open and if we can receive those messages?
I think there's another piece, Eldon, that if I may just add to what Cynthia has said, I'm actually very pleased that she remembered to raise the piece about the orbs in Chicago. I'll take the responsibility of putting a name out here because I know the person well, and I think he would be certainly okay with it. And I say this and I name it very deliberately for a good reason. This is a well-known person, Dr. Stephen Greer.
I know Stephen, who's been on the show.
Yes, I thought he had. Well, you know, Stephen, like us all who have gone public, you know, have our detractors and our supporters. And I just need to say that I have certainly witnessed with Stephen Greer in England and in other parts of the world experiences which are of a high strangeness kind. And I'm going to keep with the more positive side of what has happened around Stephen Greer here. He is the person who made that statement, and this is why I've brought this up and named him, because I was also with him in southern England, actually several times, but on this particular occasion, this was a misty night. We were in a place that very familiar to you know, people that are looking at these crop circles close to Stonehenge, and we were out there basically just hoping to see something. We didn't know what we were there looking for something. It was nighttime, it was cloudy, and I think we'd pretty well given up hope of seeing anything. Well, he went through this vectoring process that he has, and it is fairly well known about now, and suddenly an orb at very high speed came through the low cloud. It was actually just inside of the cloud. It was like lighting up like a light inside of cotton wool. And so it was illuminating the very low side of the cloud, the base of the cloud, and it shot through that sky like nothing I've ever seen. This was an orb, again. Now, this is the same man that says he's projecting himself to watch or be aware of what I'm raising at the conference. There may be some tendrils here that connect the person with the phenomenon. I don't know, but I raise that for what it's worth. We're looking at orbs, and one was on the photograph, and the other physically seen. But there were about 60 of us with him that night and witnessed that. This orb broke into two directly over our heads. An extraordinary situation.
Really interesting. So now the two that broke, let me just ask you this. I mean, when you implied earlier that, the orbs for all intent and purposes were UFOs. So what is it, like they're drones, alien drones?
Well, we really have no idea. I mean, I've been privileged to be, very much involved in the UFO research, government and non-government. I attend meetings with Minister of Defence in Great Britain on a regular basis, but not infrequently for several years on this subject. And I've certainly come in possession of material that I've been given and have witnessed myself. Some of these are in the book that declare the hand of absolute direct interaction. I just give you one very quickly that was exactly that. This was going back to, 1991, within several hundreds of yards of the Stephen Greer experience that I was talking about then. I was in
really
Japanese
quick.
Television. Yeah, very, very quickly. With NTV, saw a light in the sky, interacted with their flashes of light, flash 1, 2, 3, and the object is flashing back 1, 2, 3. Confirmed through my sources, on radar directly that night as not being aircraft of any kind. There was nothing in the area. So we're looking at intelligence interacting with humanity.
That's an incredible story. Tell me, HARP, what's your take on HARP, Colin?
Well, the reason, I think it's just worth starting, Eldon, by giving a reason why we put any of the technological questions in the book at all. And the reason was that we felt that some of these significant technologies and secret projects that are underway, we don't know what the ramifications of them are. It's much like, the levels of CO2 that we've been applying to the atmosphere would seem in part anyway, resulted in global warming. It's like, you lift a stone and out come insects you've perhaps never seen before. It's when you're challenging Mother Nature, you're challenging nature systems, one can anticipate ramifications and perhaps even new phenomena. And we felt that was important to say because there are a number of very new, unexplained, supernatural kind of things that are occurring around our planet now. And so when it came to HARP, this came in as part and parcel of something that I discovered, basically just kind of came across it as a result of an email that I received from one of the visitors to my website from Australia back 3 years ago, sending me photographs of an unusual radar pattern on the BOM site, the Bureau of Meteorology, the Australian government meteorological site, which is shown across the country, you know, as its weather system. And this was a large white ring across southwest Australia. Well, I took it and noted it, recorded it, and then came other reports across Australia. I started to delve a little bit. This is one of my subjects, and meteorology. Made inquiries of meteorological officers here and there, and was given most of them were saying, you know, this is kind of incomplete radar data that gives you this kind of dropout. It's nothing unusual. Well, it certainly became unusual as I began to record a variety of patterns not seen before. And I was then getting information coming from the technical guys who were working for BOM, asking me not to declare their names in the system. They wanted to keep their jobs. But this was nothing to do with the sensitivity levels on the radar. This was nothing they'd seen before, and it was national. Well, I could see it was national. I was getting the information from across the entire continent. And as I was logging it, I began to see that there was a pattern to this, a pattern of the patterns, and that when these patterns appeared in a certain sequence, there were then physical meteorological changes, weather changes. This was acknowledged by the Met Office, the BOM in Australia, by putting up on their screen, and it's still there to this day, seen on television screens and the internet around the world, that these are interferences they are still trying to resolve. Well, it has since also been acknowledged in Queensland that the government are involved in weather modification work, which has been funded by the Australian government. And so it led me, with other much more qualified experts in this field than myself, to look at HARP, because we were looking at interference patterns probably coming from above rather than the lateral horizontal plane. It was interfering with these signals in the radar returns, which were abnormal. It was abnormal in the sense that they'd not been seen before on any continent, let alone Australia. And so we were looking at HARP. There is a HARP facility in the northern part of the outback of Australia. And the pretty question I don't have an answer for is whether HARP is, in fact, playing a part by focusing as it's beamed high-frequency system into the regions of the weather modifications systems that have been deployed to try and improve the precipitation in a 1,000-year drought area. And let me just to conclude that in the sequence that I discovered, indeed there was the reversal of a 1,000-year drought within about 48 hours into a 100-year flood in Melbourne and Sydney, where they had not seen anything like this. And so there was a very, very serious questions have been raised whether HARP is part, and I don't have the answer for it, but what I do know is that the radar patterns and weather modification have got correlations in events that are happening in Australia. So you probably know more about HARP than I do, Eldon. That's not anything I'm an expert on, but there's a lot of, as you say, there are a lot of questions raised about the project and whether it is still online. My data has gone dead. So as far as I can see, it is offline, but I don't know whether that is, in fact, whether they've changed frequencies or what they're doing there.
You know, I know that we are all causal oriented creatures. We see a pair of scissors snip a stem and an apple falls, and well, it was the scissors that caused the apple to fall. We don't we don't look behind and think, no, it wasn't the scissors or something else called gravity that really caused it to fall.
Yeah, right.
But you know, I think you've got a smoking gun here personally. I think the causal connectedness really pushes what we mean by coincidence. I don't think the probability-wise, coincidence doesn't work for me. That's all there is to it. So, at any rate, moving right along, sir, we have been avoiding the real issue. You gave name to crop circles. And, of course, UFOs and crop circles, they've been controversial for as long as I've been around. My
sure
question.
Have.
There are hoaxes in the world. And then there are those that, I guess, are real. How do you know one from another?
It's a good question, and that was the central question for the first 15 of the last 30 years. It has been exactly that. The first thing, as engineers and scientists do is gather the data, and we were literally location looking for measurements, magnetic alignments, plant analysis, electromagnetic fields, and so on. Physical features, I employed for a period of time ex-retired police officers, police detectives who would be looking for physical evidence associated with people, and on and on and on. So in the year 2000, when I made that announcement that I was referring to earlier, that the funded operation of 2 years, 1999-2000, funded by Lawrence Rockefeller in New York, looking very specifically at the man-made, the figure transpired that 80% of that time had appeared in England were made by people. Well, so which left us 20% we had to look very closely at, because we couldn't prove that they were made by people at all. There were a lot of information that we were able to ascertain related to that 20% that came, helped me answer your question now. And so this is how it panned out. In that 20% at that time, and, I need to refer to that time and not now because things have changed. But in the year 2000, we had 20% where these were the more simple designs. That sounds counterintuitive to a lot of people, that they've been banking on the fact that the high complexity and size were impossible to be made by people, when in fact the actual data on the ground was they were more likely to be made by people, and we had evidence that most were. It did not include all of them, and that's worth saying. What was left in that 20% were the more simple designs, single circles, found by a farmer here, there, and everywhere around the planet. Two circles next to one another, three in a straight line, five forming a cross, the Celtic cross with a single ring, a double ring. And so it was like the water droplet freezing into a snowflake. The complexity began to evolve, still within that 20% of being real, where there were no tracks in, no tracks out, no powdering of the soil structure underneath the feet that would have been needed to have stood there to have made them, where we had magnetic anomalies up to 300% above the Earth's magnetic field, the five galls in the northern hemisphere, in that part of the northern hemisphere, plant anomalies that I cannot speak to because I'm not the biologist, although there are biologists who have looked at it and have said, I have some problem with some of this, but I'm just giving it to you as it has been given to me, is that there are plant anomalies here that's changed at the cellular level. So this is the real versus the man-made, where there are tracks in and out, there is soil compression, there is no magnetic anomaly, and there is plant damage. These are made by people.
Okay, well now, just a straightforward question, because there is information out there on the internet, my researchers turned up a YouTube video. Have you ever been hoaxed yourself? Have you ever, misidentified a crop circle?
Yes, I have. They were in a kind of stressful environment, and I'll try and keep this very concise. I coordinated Operation Blackbird, which was a surveillance operation with the British Army BBC Television, Nippon Television Japan, who co-funded this operation in the year 1990. And during what it was supposed to be initially a kind of a very secret operation, and the television companies were going to make their money on transmitting programs later to keep basically the public away from the site when this was going on. Lots of surveillance equipment in position. Well, it's a long story, but I'm keeping it very, very concise. I was called to the site early hours in the morning, where I was told there was a fairly elaborate, not anything like we see these days, but a fairly elaborate design had appeared in front of the cameras, and a strange light had been seen entering the field from above. Long story short is that Pat Delgado, my co-author at that time and co-researcher, colleague, who had just left his NASA job, he and I went into that field with Nippon Television cameras outside filming us, we went out on television and stated that in the first few moments of inspection, we felt we had a major event. It was quickly revealed we were foolish in the sense that we didn't wait for analysis, proper inspection, aerial surveillance. We had none of that to work with. I guess I felt feeling under the pressure of many television cameras that were gathering there, and the fact that it was going out live over the television systems around the world being beamed out by satellite. I guess we just succumbed to the situation and the pressure. We were being told to make this, put the announcement out because it was going out live on breakfast time television in Great Britain and being beamed around Good Morning America, etc., 5 hours later. So yes, we were fooled. We announced that was real when in fact it was not. Well, that's really what you're looking for there, Al.
No,
it's not a perfect, we weren't perfect, and we got it wrong.
You know what happens, Colin. You have people out there in the world that if you make one misstep, you make one mistake, you say something isn't quite right, then they look to discredit all of your work on the basis of that. And, everyone and I've interviewed a number of people, popular TV people, medium, and scientists, people like yourself who make mistakes.
Yeah.
But it takes integrity to say, I messed this one up, and this is why, and that was a mistake. And on the other hand, when you ask somebody, what about, and they go sideways on you, and they start blaming it on anyone and everyone except them, well, then you know that maybe you shouldn't be giving him any real credibility. We all make mistakes, and I want, I want our listening audience to understand that we do our homework, and if we bring somebody onto the show, and I think they're full of nonsense, I tell them so, and I tell them so right here on the air. And if there is something in the background that they should be aware of, I try to get that out. So, no, your answer, I think, is fully satisfactory as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, thank
you. Now, listen, for both of you, you're scientists. You didn't come in, you didn't graduate with any degrees in orbs or crop circles or UFOs. So it's one thing to detail your observations. That's what a scientist does. And it's another thing to imbue it with intention. But that said, who can give it intention better than the people that are doing the observations? What on earth are these crop circles, in your mind, all about?
I think what it's all about is we have been presented with a clean sheet. A stage was set in 1976 where the subject didn't exist. And as we were introduced to the subject, individuals of all kinds of researchers, all kinds of disciplines and belief systems, all slowly coming on board. As this whole thing grew, integrity became, of course, and it always does, vitally important. To where it was to evolve and where it was to go, where it was to head. We had, and you know, I was privileged to be in pretty well from the beginning in 1983, you know, hence the term crop circles, which I, you know, I coined. What we also witnessed was every element came to the forefront here. You know, we had the intelligence agencies coming in because of the public's interest, and all of that being experienced. What I think this is about, and I hope that the book kind of spells this out in some detail towards the end, is that we have here a showcase of how humanity operates. It operates in the same way inside this subject as it does in all subjects, as it does in all religions and in all politics. And what you have, I am fairly sure, this is a mirror placed upon in front of us now, and the elements that are work inside the subject are, for example, people who will say, as we touched upon this earlier, don't believe this camp because they are all real. What these guys are doing and telling you that they're hoaxes, or even any percentage of them are hoaxes, is they're damaging, you know, the spiritual intelligence behind the subject. And then you have people that are making crop circles themselves, who are not being given a voice, but hold vital clues, because these people are having the same paranormal experiences manufacturing crop circles that I have had and people like me have had in researching them. Farmers have had these experiences, but until we're all talking to one another on this piece of paper, in this stage that was set, we don't get the powerful message that is here for us. And it is, the message is that, you know, we really have to come together. We have to find our truth. We have to know who we want to be, to evolve and take advantage of the process of consciousness. And I think that really and truly is what's happening here.
Yeah, and if I could just add on to that, because I think this is an important piece of it.
Oh, I'm going to ask you, Cynthia, to hold that one and sure. Add it when we come back from the break, or the computer's going to kick us out and suddenly we'll be talking to space. All right? When we come back, Cynthia Andrews will add to her interpretation of why we have orbs in the first place. We hope you are enjoying, not orbs, I mean crop circles. Well, orbs too. We hope you are enjoying our show today with Colin and Cynthia Andrews. You can visit their website to learn more about their book and work. Go to colinandrews.net. That's colinandrews.net. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes and take your calls, so do stay tuned.
Have you talked to yourself lately? What does that inner voice say? Are you constantly hearing negative feedback? Ready for a change? InnerTalk, Eldon Taylor's patented subliminal technology, can do just that. Change your inner self-talk. Turn off the negative by replacing it with positive affirmations. InnerTalk has been researched at universities such as Stanford and by governments around the world, and has been proven effective at priming your self-talk. Armed with a new positive outlook, you'll find everything becomes easier. From losing weight, to stop smoking, giving presentations, to riding horses. Learn new things, to being a powerful salesperson. Choose your title for change today. Visit www.innertalk.com. That's InnerTalk.com. InnerTalk.com.
Every day, every moment, we face choices. Yet, how many of those choices are truly our own? Are you ready to step onto the path of discovery? Read Eldon Taylor's New York Times bestseller, Choices and Illusions, now revised, updated, and expanded. Eldon combines provocative information, scientific research, and his own life's journey into a powerful message that we have the power to change. All we must do is be willing to choose to take the chance and change. Get your copy today from all bookstores.
Hey,
Breaking Limitations is an in-depth course designed to assist you in answering the question, how did I get where I am and how do I get where I want to be? By examining the same question from the perspective of many of today's most successful luminaries and teachers, it will be possible for you to utilize the answers to get your own life, not just back on track, but back on road that stretches higher and higher. If you are enjoying Breaking Limitations, please be sure to tell a friend. Replays will be available for a limited time, so there is still time for your friends to benefit from this special telecourse. Simply click on the sharing tools found on all the Breaking Limitations web pages.
Welcome back. You know, we just aired a whole series of commercials that I happened to be just caught, and they're all about breaking limitations, and I failed to tell you about breaking limitations, but you can learn all about it by going to my website, eldentaylor.com. Listen, let's get back to the show. Before the break, Cynthia, you were going to tell us what you felt the intention of these crop circles or these visitations from UFOs were all about.
Well, and interestingly, it plays right into your commercials on breaking limitations because,
good.
You know, I really think, yeah, synchronicity at hand, I really think what the crop circles are all about is they're offering a training ground for people to really learn about the potential we have to interact with the living force of nature through sacred geometry and through our own personal intention. If you look at the experiences that people have when they go into these crop circles, whether they're human-made or not known who's made them, people have healing impacts. People have changes in brainwave states. You know, we've done some experiments on brainwaves in these crop circles and the effect that they have on our states. People have time distortions. The energy in these circles interferes with cameras. It interferes with compasses. You know, there is some force that gets generated, and in our book, in the chapter on EVP or electronic voice phenomenon, we talk about how in some of the interactions with the spirit world, it was determined that three things are necessary to create a paranormal experience. You need earth energy, you need spiritual energy, and you need human intention. And I think that's what these crop circles are training us to do, how to use our human intention combined with these two forces to create change. And, I just have to add, when Colin was talking about Australia, it shows so perfectly back to your question about what can we do. When he first started noticing these correlations between the interference patterns and the weather, he'd come and he'd talk to me about it, and I'd be like, and not really listening at all. And within like a week, he had people from all across that country. They were sending things like every 5 minutes he'd be getting email alerts. And it was like the country went on fire. And it seems to me that that's the kind of energy that we need to create the changes out of the crossroads that we're in right now.
Yeah, I think, you know, your book, you know, What You Believe Matters. And I think that's absolutely at the core of what's happening here. You know, we have to be able to imagine, embrace to before we can manifest and take advantage in a process related to that, you know, that subject matter. But the interactions that are going on between individuals and the events in those fields is central to the subject and central to the book. You know, I've had experiences myself, many others have too, where you, I'll just use the word meditate. Some would say pray, it doesn't matter. A process coming from a position deep inside and a position of sincerity, I think that's important. In my own experience, it has been. And to visualize a design, and to requesting that this manifest. I've had this myself. There have been programs made about it, and others too, where I visualized a Celtic cross that had never appeared before, not to our knowledge anywhere, on our planet, in this form. And what I asked for in my head was, please could this appear as close to my home as possible. And this will all sound, you know, kind of funny and strange and all the rest of it. And so I had I was still in that bed. I was still on the bed that night, the early of that morning of that night. And the farmers on there telling me that they've discovered a design which described as the one that I had visualized. And the field was the closest field left unharvested to my home. And that's only one of many examples of what appears to be something sat on our shoulders, aware of our thoughts, our actions, our desires, and interactions. Ultimately, interactions, people making them, have talked about exactly the same thing. They'll get an intuitive feeling of a design. They then go out and manufacture, only to find that there are people that they were totally unaware of in the same field manufacturing the same design. I mean, it's beyond the realms of possibilities that this would be simply coincidental.
There's a wonderful book that deals with that, and for all intent and purposes, lists many of those kinds of instances written by David Bohm, the Nobel Prize physicist, called Synchronicities. And, you know, it is Serendipity in Science is actually the title of the book. I'm sorry. Synchronicities would attest, as Jung would say, to some kind of collective unconscious, some kind of, you know, field out there of mind stuff. You use Rupert Sheldrake's model, not an M field from physics as they use in physics, but an M field as Sheldrake thinks of it, that morphogenic field that we tune into. And maybe like, a radio transmitter, from time to time we happen to get our own personal set in the right station setting, and we get ideas, and they're downloaded from this M field. And, you know, people from around the world seem to be able to, given that they're concentrating on the same kind of issue or have the same kinds of questions in their mind, tune in and synchronistically find themselves making collateral discoveries at precisely the same moment in time. Now, you know, when you, since you brought HARP back up, one of the things that disturbed me about HARP is its ability to entrain brainwave patterns, actually, you know, slow down the brainwave, and in that process it changes mood states, because slowing the brainwave changes the neurochemicals that are going into the body. Patrick Flanagan, Dr. Flanagan, informed me that in a conversation that we had several years ago, that he was absolutely convinced that that was as much the purpose behind HARP as pounding, to use the words of my friend Dr. Nick Begich, as pounding the ionosphere with this aural pulse. Your thoughts on that?
I have to say, I find it a scary thought, of course, to think that any group of scientists or governments or combination of both would feel to take it upon themselves, without debate, discussion, or any forum, international forum, of consequences, taking on such responsibility and interfering, you might say, with nature and the God force, if such a thing exists. I think it's just extraordinary. But I think we've seen plenty of late on the political front. You know, the NSA front in particular, without kind of going perhaps off too much in the deep end, to suspect that these people, some of these people, are capable of anything. Such madness beyond the realms of reason. I don't know. I don't know that I can add much to the eloquence with which you put that out there. I would be fearful of such intrusion into thought patterning, but something is doing it. I mean, I'm taking your point here in the order in which you came with that, because something is responsible and an intelligence is behind the intuitive sense or feeling that, or prompting of a design placed in the heads of a circle maker or a circle researcher or a UFO experience, the attractor of a UFO experience. We've talked about them during this program, it's initiated from somewhere. Is this, and I would ask the same question back really to our audience, is the evidence that this is some clandestine secret government operation? Is this the United States perhaps or others working with an extraterrestrial species and taking advantage of information, knowledge and technology? Or is it a process of human-to-human communication, like remote viewing in reverse? I think these are reasonable questions. As all scientists, we start with what we know and head towards trying to resolve what we don't. And what we know, and I'm totally confident on this one, this is why, we both, confidently put our names to this book, is that there is another intelligence at work here. And we simply don't know what it is and where it comes from. So I think HARP and its involvement, possible potential involvement in some of this should not be certainly overlooked.
Well, I'll tell you what. I don't think you're on any deep end when you start talking about the NSA and PRISM and some of these things that are going on right now. But okay, we'll leave that. That's a whole nother show. Let's do this. UFOs, the mainstream science dismisses UFOs by way of aliens and has done for, time immemorial. I'll get that said correctly. And yet recently, the former defense minister of Canada, Paul Hellyer, not only stepped out and said aliens are real, but he decided to tell us that there were different races, four types of alien species visiting Earth. You have comments on that?
Yes, I think first to say that I acknowledge and respect and thank him for his courage in stepping forward. Credibility is a very big problem in this field. Maintaining it whilst opening honest discussion and debate is a very big deal. So I would first want to say that. But secondly, my own information, and again another program really, Eldon, is that yes, I would go along with him. I can give you two examples directly from people that I again respect. A police sergeant responsible for part of the a town that in Wiltshire, England, where the crop markings are, very close to Silbury Hill. It's an archaeological site there, largest man-made mound in Europe, where at 5 o'clock in the morning, this police officer, who is trusted to for his word and his honesty, and has placed people in prison for the rest of their lives. On that day, he's coming back off of duty and sees three tall beings in a field right alongside the highway. And these tall beings are all looking identical with long blonde hair, silver suited arrangements with the hoods dropped at the back of their necks. They're about 7 feet tall, appear to be more to be floating than doing anything. In the field, one has a wand kind of arrangement which he's pushing through the heads of the wheat there on the edge of a Mayan headdress design, crop circle marking. And this is actually an ongoing research investigation as I speak to you. This was 3 years ago, but it's an ongoing situation. This policeman, everything changed for him. He had a time loss when he left the field. I'm just kind of cutting it down here a little bit. There's a lot of detail. But he left. He reached home. He had lost time. Something he says, using his words, went home with him because things began to happen there too. There were taps at the door. Nobody was there. There were lights appearing over the roof of his house. Electrical equipment started to malfunction. And then three tall beings woke the two, he and his wife, up in the middle of the night. Were illuminated and literally like light beings in their room several weeks after that event. These were scorch marks left in the carpets. Analysis has revealed that there are mercury traces in those scorches, etc., etc. And so this is as close as we're going to get, I think, to, you know, categoric evidence that extraterrestrials, or we'll just determine that, exist. You know, there are many examples of them. The tall beings, I've done this several times in the program, and I apologize for bringing it back to me. I didn't
Please.
Well, thank you. It is that I can speak confidently of them. You know, rather than leave a question mark, I can say, you know, I have witnesses or what to this experience. When I was 5 years old, this probably is going to take longer than we have time to complete as a complete detailed account. But I was regressed, I think, to start here, following what I had experienced twice when I was 5 years old, which I had kept secret for many years. Most of the years up to just recently, and I had experienced what I thought were dreams of being lifted up out of my body, tugging my solar plexus, floating, looking down at my younger sister Valerie and Peter, my younger brother, with mum and dad in the house, and floating towards the back of the house, which is where my dream terminated. And talked until Professor Jim Harder, University of Berkeley, who had worked on the Blue Book with Professor Hynek, mm-hmm. came to regress me in the presence of Cynthia and his wife. And out of my mouth, in 45 minutes, which I felt like about 6 minutes, 5 or 6 minutes, came another chapter. And, you know, the chapter goes on. It came out of my mouth under regression. He had, incidentally, left Travis Walton and Betty and Barney Hill, that they had also been regressed and had experiences not so dissimilar to some of mine. And, you know, I went through the wall into a very bright white light. There was a being, and they're back now to the ET and to the extraterrestrial and the Canadian minister. Here I was looking at a being, looking at me, floated onto a plinth inside of this very bright light, which was not at all bright inside, and these large-eyed individual saying to me inside of my head, "We are sorry to be doing this to you, but this is for a future time." And today, and Cynthia is here with me now, as you know, we flew to England to investigate things that I was told during regression, and they were verified on site. Where that bright white light was at the back of my house in 1954, when I was only 5 years old, there is still growing today a 35-foot diameter dark green ring to this day. And the plants that I was told that would be there at certain places, that the scientists could evaluate the state and condition of our planet today, are there. And so I have no doubt, no question, whether I was biased deliberately by an experience before I saw the first crop circle. I was certainly in a circle, which is still there today, back when I was 5 years old. Long story, and I rushed it to give you kind of the brief major pieces of it. The detail is in the book, but we're back to E.T. We're back to E.T. again as an involvement here somewhere.
Right. That was an important story, though. You know, Cynthia, have you had any personal involvement yourself, first-hand knowledge that you want to add to what Colin just shared?
You know, mine have been a little less spectacular than that, I have to say, with the exception of one incident that we had together in, I think it was 1993 or 4, I can't remember the year exactly, but it is written in the book, but we were in bed, both of us woken up, only I couldn't move. I was just kind of turned off but awake. And Colin sat up in bed, and it was as if he expanded in my sight, like he just became very enlarged, and there was this living light in the room. During that period of time, he was receiving information, which I'm sure he'll tell you about, but essentially related to the triangular geometry and how, when that is applied to the landscape with the crop circles, it created a particular type of energy. So then he suddenly deflated, and I just began to expand, and I could just feel myself suddenly huge in the room, and again, this light. And I started receiving information, and the information was about triangles in the body and how when you activate these triangles in the body, it activates a healing force. And so when it just kind of went, the light just went out and I deflated and we were sitting there looking at each other and, you know, what was that, and talking and realizing we had received exactly the same piece of information, just applied in different places. And it is ongoing research as to what this triangulation actually means, and how it can be used. That would be probably my most dramatic experience.
Yeah, I mean, our physiology, you know, the human body was interfered with and manipulated. I mean, we were both woken from deep sleep. We were both in a paralyzed kind of state. We couldn't move. To me, it felt like there was a external connection that was so efficient, so perfect. It was like the light was burning so bright, and yet it's like a rheostat being turned down. The light is dimming. The connection was being lost. And when it changed state as it left, and this extraordinary information had been laid out in front of me like a movie, I could move. Once it had gone and I could feel the change of state occurring, I could move. And it was like, you know, suddenly it's like, well, that was just extraordinary. What just happened? I've got to remember this. And, you know, what was laid out in front of my eyes was a triangulation of each of the designs that had been placed there by people or not in colors representing years. And they were coming in one after the other, forming an equilateral triangle across central southern England, giving me the dimensions of 41.5 miles down three of the legs to the ancient towns that they encompassed, and indicating that if I were to draw a vertical line from halfway along the base of this triangle, it would encompass precisely through Stonehenge. And the moment I looked at the, you know, I have maps of this. This is something I've looked at every day of my life since 1983. It was precise, absolutely precise.
We're going to have to leave it there, Colin. Everybody's got to get this book. You have to leave them dangling, you know. We're simply out of time. But I want everybody once again to know how to contact you, whether or not they can email you, ask you questions, and where to get the book. Real quickly, sir.
Yes, thank you very much, Alden. It's colinandrews.net is the website, and the books, including, of course, On the Edge of Reality, are available at Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com. Cynthia's books are also available on her website, which is
andrewshealingarts.com.
I didn't know about your website. I'm sorry about that. Say it again. Andrew's Healing Arts?
Yep, andrewshealingarts.com, and both of my books, The Path of Energy and The Path of Emotion, are available through my website or at Barnes & Noble and Amazon.
Yeah, and they're also, aren't they also at Colin's website?
Yes,
they are
also
at
Colin's, yes.
All right, okay. Well, I'm sorry, but this week I must jump straight over to an online event for Hay House. So we have something special for you coming up in about 1 minute. Therefore, today we've come to the end of another hour of Provocative Enlightenment, and I want to thank our guests. I don't know where my voice is going. And all of you for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed our show, and we'll join us again next week, same time, same place. And if you have comments on our show, do remember, let us know. Okay, until next time, wherever you are in the world, remember, believing in yourself always matters.
This from my friend, author and performer, Dee Dee Mercer Moffat, The 12 Days of Inner Talk. Dee Dee has used Inner Talk to accomplish some truly remarkable feats. Congratulations, Dee Dee.
Provocative Enlightenment has been brought to you by Progressive Awareness Research and other sponsors. Provocative Enlightenment is a syndicated show and appears on other networks. For a schedule of show times, visit provocativeenlightenment.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, write to Eldon at eldontaylor.com.